Hawking radiation in one picture is really, we can identify it in flat space-time already. Here's a picture of Minkowski space. And that's the light cone of one point. And you can imagine a plane, two dimensions perpendicular to this board. And we can divide space like this. And we can imagine the hyperbolic rotation symmetry or boost symmetry around this point or this plane that moves points like that. And we can talk about the vacuum of any relativistic quantum field theory on this space-time. And let's call that vacuum state O. This is Minkowski space.
I always thought that was zero, not O.
Oh, okay. Zero. The vacuum is not nothing.
Well, I thought zero particles, that's what it meant.
Okay. So that's the Minkowski vacuum of any QFT. So this is the vacuum of any Lorentz invariant, a stable quantum field theory. Then we can ask the question, what if we only are allowed to look at this quantum field observables on one side of space? This is the left side of space and the right side. Then what does this vacuum look like? And the way we answer that is we write down the pure state density matrix for the vacuum, and then we do a partial trace over the left-hand side of space from here to here. So now we get something else. That's the reduced density matrix. And it turns out it's thermal. It has this form of a thermal distribution. Minus, where H boost is the Hamiltonian that generates this symmetry on Minkowski space. H bar is Planck's constant. And that has dimensions of action. So H boost should also have dimensions of action, not energy. And it does because it's a generator of a rotation, in this case, a hyperbolic rotation, but a rotation. So anyway, this is it. So this is Minkowski space is thermal. And that's a global statement. We can talk about this mode by mode, looking at a particular wave packet of some definite frequency with respect to the boost Hamiltonian outside the horizon. And it turns out that in this vacuum state, it's correlated to, it has a particular structure. Now I'm going to write it down, I guess, in a simple way for a free field theory. So for example, the quantum state of these two modes, this is a, let me give this a name too, I'll call it A. And it has a partner mode on the other side I'll call A tilde. And these two guys are in an entangled quantum state, and the state looks like this. The state of the A mode, or A tilde, goes like a sum over excitation number n in the A mode and n in the A tilde mode. I'll call it n tilde. Well, I want it to be the same. A tilde A with a square root of that coefficient, basically e to the minus pi n omega summed over n. So this is an entangled state. And the key thing is that A is supposed to be somehow completely supported outside this horizon in this region. And its partner is completely supported inside. So there's entanglement across the horizon in this way. OK, so then what is Hawking radiation is we can think about in any space-time this picture happening locally, because every point in any space-time is like Minkowski space. So let's say we have a black hole horizon. It's a black hole horizon. And we pick a point on it and think about that like this point here. And then we'll identify the horizon, which is a null surface, with this null surface. And then we can look at two local modes, like these two modes right here, which I can call again A and A tilde. And in the local vacuum in the black hole spacetime, these two modes near the horizon where you can't tell the difference between Minkowski space and a black hole, they are in a similar state to this. So they're entangled. But what's different is that in the black hole case, this, because of the position-dependent gravitational potential, basically, this mode will eventually climb away from the horizon, whereas in Minkowski space, it just goes on forever. And its partner on the inside will fall inwards. So the vacuum is peeled apart, and as this mode with some excitation number anywhere from n equals 0 to whatever, it propagates away from the horizon and would be detected somewhere over here as a excitation of that field mode, otherwise known as a Hawking particle or Hawking quantum. Meanwhile, it came from this state in which it was clear that it's entangled with its partner. So that Hawking particle is entangled with something that's behind the black hole horizon. So this is the starting point. So suppose now we make a black hole out of collapsing matter. This is a space-time picture, and horizon forms. And Hawking radiation begins to happen. So here we have a pair, and another pair, another pair. And as time goes on, these particles that propagate away from the black hole are carrying energy. So they're draining energy away from the black hole, and it's shrinking. It's losing mass, and so its horizon is shrinking. And eventually, let's say it goes away completely. So let's imagine that's the scenario. And then there's the last Hawking quantum there. So at infinity, you can imagine a kind of S matrix experiment you did. You threw in the matter that formed the black hole. It went on for a while, evaporating by Hawking radiation. And as it did so, you and your friends are collecting all the Hawking photons at infinity. And every single one that you collect is entangled with something else that was behind the horizon. Now, what's happening behind the horizon? Well, we know up to a point. At some point in there, according to classical general relativity, there's a singularity. What really happens, we don't know all the way inside. But unless somehow these partners can escape and also come out to infinity and restore the purity of the state, it looks like you're just going to have a mixed state at infinity. So it looks like the black hole evaporation is not unitary, and it loses information. Information is lost. Okay, so certainly this is what Hawking thought, information was lost. For a long time, it's been thought by some people that information is lost, including myself. But suppose you just, for a minute, just suppose you believe for some reason, you may have various reasons, that it can't be true that it's not unitary. That really the whole process in the end must be unitary. So I'm going to now tell you where the firewall comes from. So the firewall argument is conclusion comes from the assumption that the process is in fact unitary. And we'll talk later about whether, you know, whether there's any reason to think it is.
Ted?
Yeah.
You mean not unitary, but unitary with respect to if there is an infinity.
Right. That's all we need here for this firewall argument.
Right, but it could be unitary, but there could be other boundaries.
Right.
Other
yeah, definitely, and that'll be a focus of later part of the talk.
Okay.
So, okay, so the statement was, but suppose it is unitary. Actually, unitary. Okay, and suppose that we form the black hole, just to keep it simple, with a pure state of collapsing matter. Then all of the Hawking quanta must be in a pure state when taken together at the end. It could be that this particular one, the first one out, is not in a pure state. These three are still not in a pure state. But eventually, and in fact, as argued by Don Page, no later than halfway through this evaporation process, the later Hawking quanta had better be entangled with the earlier ones. Because taken together, all the quanta must be in a pure state. If these are all mixed, the only way to make the whole thing pure is if they're entangled with the rest. And if you wait longer than half of them, if more than half of them have come out and you're still in a completely mixed state, there aren't enough of them left to purify the early ones. So the argument goes, no later than halfway, some Hawking quantum coming out had better be entangled with the early Hawking quanta. Let's call the early ones E. This particular one will be A, like I referred to it before, and its partner I'll call A tilde. And the problem then is just that, well, if A is completely entangled with A tilde, it can't also be entangled with E. And to make this sound fancy and convince the skeptics, the strong subadditivity of entanglement entropy, or of von Neumann entropy is invoked. Maybe it's worth actually saying what that is. So suppose we have a quantum system that's got a Hilbert space that's a tensor product of three factors. We'll call them A tilde, A, and E. And we can define, so we have some quantum state on this system. It could be a mixed state or a pure state. And we can define the reduced density matrix for any subsystem. In particular, we could consider just A tilde or just E. And taken alone, remember, E is going to have entropy in this scenario if the early Hawking quanta came out in a mixed state. So the hope is, according to this idea, that by considering the subsystem that includes A with E, the entropy AE would be less than the entropy of E itself. That would be needed to restore the unitarity. So to restore the unitarity, or the purity of the Hawking radiation, we would need, in this scenario where E was mixed so far, we would need the entropy of EA to be less than the entropy of E by itself. The problem is, if A is entangled with A tilde, and then you consider A as a subsystem together with E, then you're breaking this entanglement, and therefore A will have some extra entropy due to the missing information about its entanglement with A tilde. And that can be quantified in a simple inequality. Namely, we can consider the two subsystems A tilde A or AE, and we have this inequality that S A tilde A plus S of AE is greater than or equal to the separate entropies of A tilde and E. So now, if it's true that the state of A and A tilde is like I just indicated here, it's some entangled but pure state, then the entropy of A A tilde would be zero. And that would then this inequality would tell us that AE entropy is not only greater than the entropy of E, which violates what we needed, it's greater than that plus the entropy of A tilde. The only way around this is if we avoid, if we have a non-zero value here, big enough to allow this entropy to actually be less than this entropy. But to have a non-zero value for this would imply that the state of A and A tilde is in fact not this, because that is a pure state. The vacuum state of A and A tilde is pure. And here we need it to be not this state, because it can't be pure, because if it is, we can't restore purity of the Hawking radiation. So the conclusion is, therefore, if you know the evaporation is unitary, then it must be not in the vacuum state. A and A tilde must not be in the vacuum state. And then you actually have a firewall. So what's this firewall? What's the front? So suppose this was the pair and they're actually not in their vacuum state. Then if we trace that pair backwards, instead of just sort of receding into a vacuum fluctuation that carries no energy, it's going to be some excited state above the vacuum. And it blue shifts backwards in time because of the gravitational redshift going forwards in time. So it implies that, you know, all you have to know about is local quantum field theory to make this argument. Just one sec.
Sure.
It seems to imply that the local state near the horizon where this pair would have come from involves a highly excited state of the quantum field and with a large energy density, and that's called the firewall. Yeah.
So what happened to E tilde?
E.
So like there's this early radiation field, and there should be, like you're saying that there's A and there's A tilde, and A tilde falls into the hole and A comes out.
Oh, I
see. Shouldn't that happen with E as well? I'm trying to figure out where E tilde went.
Right. Yes, in this picture, it's over here.
Okay, but you're not using it in your monogamy calculation later on, right?
Right.
So I'm not really sure why we can just throw it away.
The idea was that it's not, what's out here at infinity is E, not E tilde. So, and for unitarity of the S matrix, E should be, well, all the radiation should be in a pure state in the end. So
the claim is that E is a pure state, therefore we can separate it from E tilde. That sounds like what you're saying, but maybe I misinterpreted.
No. So the claim is E tilde is localized inside the horizon.
Okay.
We're talking about what can be observed at infinity.
But so is A tilde. Why then do you consider
right.
A tilde? Because
yeah, it's localized. It's also localized behind the horizon.
But why do you consider A tilde in the argument?
Just because I'm trying to argue that beyond halfway, that it better, if this is not yet, sorry, I'm trying to explain that if you believe that A is going to help to purify E, then A cannot be completely entangled with A tilde. That's all I'm trying to
think. You can make the same argument with E tilde. That's the form in which I originally made it.
No, because you could say the people that argue this.
You can say that E tilde is entangled with E with the.
But Raphael.
Whatever happens later cannot undo that. When you trace out E tilde, you'll have entropy outside.
No, see, this is what's not what one is not willing to say, whatever happens later can't undo that. The philosophy here is you might say, well, I don't know the quantum gravity subtleties of the Hawking effect. This is what the recent firewall, the way of posing the argument was made. I don't know the quantum gravity subtleties. It may be that for a while radiation comes out in an impure state because it is entangled with its partner.
Yeah.
But later, but it better not be too late, later it ends up being purified by virtue of entanglement with the later radiation. And then the argument is...
How would the original quanta E, how would that ever get unentangled with...
This is very... I'm so glad you asked me. So here's how it would happen. There's the classic analogy of, let's forget about a black hole. Let's take a lump of coal at 0 degrees Kelvin, shine a laser in a pure state on it and heat it up, and then let it start radiating away all that energy. For a while, photons will come out in a mixed state and they won't be entangled with each other. They'll be entangled with the stuff back in the lump of coal. But eventually, about halfway through the whole process, the later photons coming out will start to decrease the total entropy, and the total entropy of the radiation will go up and then come back down and go to zero.
But isn't it?
That's the model that people have.
But I object specifically because entropy is unitarily invariant. So isn't the idea that entropy is changing a unitary, like a non-unitary process right there?
No, but, because you're just talking about a subsystem. The coal is here, the radiation is there. So
right,
the entropy of just the radiation goes up and then back down.
Okay, maybe I'll have to think about it a bit more.
The whole system in that case would have zero entropy the whole time. Fine-grained entropy, yeah.
This is maybe a detail, but maybe not. Is the rate of production of photons the same even as the temperature is changing? Because the power radiated goes like the temperature times the area, and the area is shrinking and the temperature is increasing.
Right.
So it's not really halfway.
I think it's halfway in the number of photons or something.
That's the argument you made, but... But
as an information theoretic sense,
this would be.
But anyway, that's really a fine point.
The analogy with the coal doesn't work because information is getting out from inside the coal, which is fine. But information can't get out from inside.
No, but you're assuming it can't get out. See, I guess I didn't do a good job of explaining.
Well, otherwise,
no.
It can get out. Then, of course, you can make any number.
The interesting thing about the firewall argument, whatever you believe about the hypotheses, I think, is that, and the reason people get so agitated and excited about it, is that what you're saying, that the argument still works regardless of what you're saying. If you believe that the total radiation at infinity collected up is going to be in a pure state, but you don't claim to know so much about the black hole that you say nothing can come out. Maybe it comes out. Maybe there's some quantum gravity. Maybe there's some quantum gravity process that is too subtle to be captured in this semi-classical calculation. And the later Hawking radiation really does come out correlated to the early Hawking radiation. Then the argument says, but if that's true, then the later Hawking radiation cannot be correlated to its partner appropriately. And so then, even if you admit that, then you're going to have a firewall. That's the logic. And I think that's the mindset of the people that made the argument. They do believe in unitarity, and they do believe there are things about non-perturbative quantum gravity that might have escaped understanding in the process. But nevertheless, this argument can lead to the conclusion that there would have to be a firewall. And that's a shocking conclusion for anybody. So now we have to find out what's wrong with the argument or learn to live with firewalls.
So can you avoid this argument if something that you might have sort of addressed this based on check? Can you avoid this argument if something stores all the E tilde stuff and the A tilde and everything, and then that stuff literally leaks out at the end so you don't actually have to do it?
Yeah.
So that would work.
Yeah.
Bizarre, but it would work.
Yeah.
That's the remnant.
Is there something about a holographic, you violate holographic bond on the...
What?
Sure. I mean, you
violate a strong form of the Bekenstein bound, but that's what Bekenstein actually demonstrated is that the rate of information transfer through the channel of the horizon is bounded by the area. Bekenstein did not demonstrate that the amount of entropy in the system inside the horizon is bounded by the entropy.
Right. No, it's a conjecture. It's not the proof that, that you're saying.
It's not only a conjecture. It's a conjecture that has no basis in the history of the argument, but it's made anyway.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. So that's the. So now we've established the nature of the argument, at least. I'll be here until the end of May. on and off. Okay.
But
so
if you're willing to say information's coming out, that seems even more radical than any other, you know, firewall.
Well,
but isn't that just the unitarity? A statement of unitarity says that everything that goes in comes out. So that's.
No, I mean, if you want to say that information can get out from inside the black hole across the horizon.
Yeah, if it's in, it's like there's a nugget at the end that all of a sudden flashes and says, here I am.
Well, that may be another way.
Okay, let me continue.
Well, sure, or the nugget can be another boundary. Yeah. But I mean, if you don't want that, then it might flash.
Okay.
I mean, Ted's going to be arguing the opposite, right? So we should probably let him get on with this argument.
Okay.
Especially given that it's not responsible for the firing.
So it seems like the obvious conclusion is it's not unitary, and it's certainly what many people have thought for 40 years. I've thought it for 30 years or something. So that's the obvious conclusion, and that's the end of it. So why is it interesting to think about? For me, it's interesting because actually I changed my mind about the obvious conclusion being that it's not unitary. And even if you didn't change your mind, I think that what I'm going to show you should at least make it interesting to entertain the possibility that it's not unitary. Sorry, that it is unitary. And what's so interesting about that is that if it is unitary, and you don't want to live with firewalls, you have to come up with some flaw in this argument. And what's interesting is to find the flaw. And what I'm going to say is basically that the flaw in the argument is linked intimately to the reason for it being unitary. Okay. And this isn't really anything that I thought of, I would say. Everything I know about this, I basically learned from Don Maroff. I think he wrote a revolutionary paper in 2009 that's completely underappreciated. I'll put the reference down here. It's volume 70, PRD 79. It's called Unitarity and Holography in Gravitational Physics.
This is just an ad hominem question, but Don is an advocate of the firewall.
Actually, he's not an advocate. I would say he doesn't yet see any way out of the firewall argument, but he still thinks there. I think he probably still thinks there is some way out. I don't understand why.
You're relying on this.
Exactly. I think the paradox is that Don thinks there's a paradox, and I checked with him as of yesterday to make sure that he's still
there. But this is before he had that, right? This is before the firewall.
This is before the firewall argument. Anyway, I think this resolves the whole puzzle in a super interesting way. Now, this paper involves both asymptotically flat and asymptotically ADS gravity. And asymptotically ADS. The arguments are simpler in the ADS case, and there's an interesting connection to ADS-CFT. So in this particular talk, I'm going to just focus on this one. But we can talk about this separately. He, according to Don, basically the fundamentals of the conclusion apply also to asymptotically flat gravity. I don't even think it matters. It's still interesting if they only applied to ADS. It's still just as interesting if you can have an argument for unitarity and an escape from the firewall argument. Yeah, Lee.
That's really what I've been querying.
My impression is that the argument is wrong for us about U5 for reasons that we can talk about.
It's less clear to me. Let's definitely talk about it. I did check with Don. He thinks it's not as strong, but it's still a good argument. Okay, so what is this argument? The basic thing is to remember, which nobody essentially has done in discussing this, which is kind of crazy, is that we're talking about quantum gravity. It's not quantum field theory on curved spacetime. So a fundamental question like the unitarity of the process should be posed in the context of full quantum gravity, where the diffeomorphism invariance of the theory is taken into account. So Don says, remember, in a diffeo-invariant theory, you know, we have constraints that generate the diffeomorphisms, C mu, which is zero mu Einstein equations. Constraints, they generate diffeos. And the Hamiltonian, and everything has hats on it here, okay? I'm speaking about quantum mechanics now. So it's sort of formal, but we feel like if we can quantize general relativity, preserving the diffeomorphism invariance, then what I'm saying here must be true in some sense. So the Hamiltonian then will be an integral over some space-like hypersurface of constraints times multipliers, plus a boundary term. Actually, I'll just write it this way. H on the boundary. And physical observables should commute with the constraints. Commute with C mu. So the commutator of O with C mu is zero. And that means that when we evolve observables by this Hamiltonian, they don't see this term, they only see the boundary term. And therefore, they evolve by the boundary term. H O is equal to H boundary O. Let me see. So let's draw a picture then of compactified ADS space, asymptotically ADS rather. Consider this slice we're talking about here, sigma, and its boundary is intersecting the boundary of the asymptotic ADS boundary, rather. And Don says, yes?
Before you get up, there's a, this is what people certainly believe in when you do canonical quantum gravity.
Right.
But there's an argument that Claudio Teitelbaum made many years ago. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's something that I sort of believe on the odd days of the month, and I'm not so sure on the even days of the month. But that if you work in a path integral formulation, then you don't actually satisfy the constraints. That is, the wave function evolved by produced by evolving via a path integral does not satisfy the constraints in this form.
Right.
How would that impact this whole discussion if that turns out to be right? I mean, this would be the another aspect of that's specifically quantum gravity as opposed to any other gauge theory.
But there was a particular argument based on whether you also sum over negative or positive values for Laplacian shift.
Yes.
And he argued for causality and you should only do it for positive.
Yeah, I don't know, because what he was saying was that the path integral wouldn't impose the constraint because you're only integrating over positive lapsed. But then what that would say about, let's say, matrix elements of observables and physical states, I don't know. And I never heard him make the claim that it would imply that this is not true. It might, I don't know. Okay, so what that actually means is then, here's the reason this is relevant here, is Don says, let's consider the algebra of observables at the boundary. So we could imagine that we're doing some kind of, well, let me get to that in a second. So we'll call that algebra A infinity. This is the algebra of boundary observables. One of the elements of that algebra is the Hamiltonian itself, this boundary term here. And so this includes the Hamiltonian. And we can ask, how do the boundary observables evolve if we go from one time slice to another in the boundary? Well, they would evolve by e to the I ht observable e to the minus I ht. We could expand that out in an infinite series of commutators. And since the Hamiltonian that they're commuting with in that series is in this algebra, the commutators are all, once again, in the algebra. And so the algebra evolves to itself. And therefore, that algebra at time t, let's call it, and up here, the same boundary algebra at time t prime, are equal. They're the same algebra. That is, every observable, basically, you could just evolve. If you want to know expectation value of some observable up here, you just evolve it backwards in time by the Hamiltonian and take its, I'm in the Heisenberg picture here, and take its expectation value in the state at an earlier time. It's a kind of trivial sounding observation. But what it means is that if you just have access to boundary observables, you never lose any information about your boundary observables. One sec. And he called that property, the fact that they evolve unitarily by H boundary, boundary unitarity. Yeah.
This is precluding by fiat the possibility that there's a baby universe and so there's a second boundary.
No, it is not. So there could be another boundary inside here.
In which case, there are operators in A infinity that have values on the whole manifold, including on the other boundary.
No, by definition of A infinity, these are observables at this boundary.
Wait a minute. There's a difference between observables which commute with the Hamiltonian constraints with laps set to zero on the boundary.
Right.
And observables which are just at the boundary, which are
right.
Functions of operators at
right.
The boundary. And the full set of physical observables includes lots of things which include more than or other than observables which are functionals of fields at the boundary.
Exactly. Most likely they do. Perturbatively, he showed they don't, but non-perturbatively, almost certainly they would or easily could. I have no objection. So you emphasized a really crucial point here. This is not, and there's no claim that it is, the full algebra of observables. Most likely, let's say, there are other observables that are, let's call them non-boundary bulk observables, or baby universe observables, or other boundary observables.
In the asymptotically flat case, we know that A infinity is just the conserved quantities.
It's just what?
Just the conserved quantities, just the energy, the momentum, and the multiple angular momentum, and possibly depending on the...
No, it's actually an extremely rich algebra of observables. And this is where, exactly where doing the ADS case becomes extremely...
Well, this is different than the asymptotically flat case. In the asymptotically flat case, depending on the quantities you choose, you either get just the conserved quantities or you get those plus the multiple moments.
I think that in the okay. Let me first answer the first. In the ADS case, this is an extremely rich, algebra of observables. By invoking or alluding to ADS CFT, we can identify this algebra. Let's say there's plausible evidence, at least, that this algebra can be identified with the algebra of observables of the conformal field theory in ADS-CFT duality, which is certainly not just energy, angular momentum, and so forth. Now, in asymptotically flat, the structure of the boundary is very different. We have, you know, spatial infinity, and then we have null infinity. And I think, I don't know exactly, but if you restrict to I naught itself, it's not even, there's no even sense of evolution. So I don't know what it means to say that it's conserved. But if we say that the analog of this boundary is more like the all of scry plus itself, then I think we probably have a whole lot more observables. There's probably a parallel story to the one that works in ADS-CFT, but I don't know what it is, involving the BMS group instead of the conformal group, and involving a field theory on scry plus. But in any case, we shouldn't be distracted by this very interesting technical question, because we got a simpler setting where we don't have to disagree or even not know, and it's clear that there's a non-trivial content to the statement that this algebra is preserved in time. It's got a huge amount of information in it. In particular, it could have all the information about what that's what I need to connect it to, is the black hole firewall. This is, you know, what's happening in this space. What we want to do now is invoke the preservation of this algebra in a setting where we create a black hole and it evaporates. And then, you know, pose this unitarity question in that setting.
Can I come back to Lee's question? I mean, suppose there's another boundary. How do we know the Hamiltonian? If we think of a fixed space-time, we won't have this worry. But if we're doing full quantum gravity, how do we know that the piece of the Hamiltonian that lives on that boundary doesn't act to evolve the observables on the outer boundary?
Unless there's a non-local interaction term between the two boundaries in the theory, then by definition of being at the boundary, it can't, because it's just acting at the other boundary.
Well, yeah, so how do you know there's not this non-local? I mean,
well,
taking the constraints and everything into account. I mean, we don't, how do you know, if you're going to make the argument, it seems like it's an argument with the gander and the goose or something. I mean, you're going to make some argument that the boundary is effectively tied to the interior.
Is
so what, effectively tied to the interior
to
something
in
some
the
form. Why can't it also be tied to the other boundary by the same?
Oh, it certainly could be entangled with the other boundary.
No, I mean,
and if that's what you mean by
tied.
No, but I'm not saying it's tied dynamically to the interior. I'm just going to evolve the boundary with the boundary Hamiltonian here. I'm not saying I need the interior bulk Hamiltonian to evolve the boundary. No more would I say that
No, you're not saying that. Well, okay, let's see how it goes. But in any case, you're making a, let's say that there's an assumption here. Is it an assumption, or is it built in your view, to the formalism?
I think it's some kind of an assumption. It's an assumption that the diffeomorphism invariance carries over to the quantum theory. It's an assumption that H is self-adjoint on some Hilbert space, and it's an assumption that there's no non-local interaction between this boundary and some interior boundary. And you would assume it because the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian is local, and you know, we don't know of any.
But we always have to say local with respect to what?
Well, I mean, it just has built out derivatives of local fields.
No, that's true.
So I'm just saying there's no reason. I mean, yeah, I'm happy to say that we're assuming that. But it's not like a random assumption. It comes from the structure of the theory.
If your theory has a conserved charge and is not coupled to a long-range gauge field, there can be little atoms that which carry that conserved charge to start off on the initial time-space-like boundary, never come near the boundary,
and never influence the boundary and just last till the final space like surface and are not measurable at infinity.
Sure, that might perfectly well be true. It's no, it doesn't create any problem for this line of thinking. The only claim is that the observables at infinity evolve unitarily. Remember, this is what was used in the firewall argument. It's an S-matrix type of setup. You throw some stuff into the space-time, you make the black hole, it evaporates, you see what comes out, and you know, do you have any reason to think that what you see coming out is related to what you threw in by unitary evolution? Did you lose any information during the process? And Don's observation is that during any process, you can never lose any information at the boundary. It's not to say that you have all information that there is in the theory, but whatever was there at the boundary doesn't get lost. Okay, so then let's make up a situation where we do create a black hole and try to see where the firewall goes. So you can actually make a black hole in this kind of setting by modifying the boundary conditions temporarily and generating excitations that propagate inward and collide and make a black hole. And that's okay. That means the Hamiltonian at the boundary is not the one I wrote before, but it has an explicit time-dependent piece in it. But that doesn't make it not Hermitian or not self-adjoint. So now the black hole is formed.
I'm sorry, but why do we have to do this? You can't just have ordinary matter. Why do you have to go outside the...
It's tricky. It's because with asymptotically ADS boundary conditions, basically nothing ever escapes from the space-time or comes in from the boundary. It's different from... Yeah, yeah, exactly. So in fact, I was just going to say that here. So say we've created our black hole this way, and Hawking radiation begins. With this reflecting boundary condition, what would happen is this Hawking quanta would just basically fall back into the space-time. And you'd never actually detect a Hawking quantum at the boundary. So in order to be able to talk about the question in a sharp way, you want to modify the boundary condition so you can detect the Hawking quanta. And there's a way of doing that which was given the name, well, by coupling the boundary values of the bulk fields to an auxiliary system called the evaporon. And that was an idea worked out by, I have a reference here, Rocha, J-HEP, 2008. So it's basically just introduce another system, like let's say of a field that lives in one dimension, non-compact, that couples locally at points to the asymptotic values of the bulk fields and can basically suck up Hawking quanta, absorb their energy, and deposit the energy in the evaporon reservoir. And that way, then we can enhance the boundary observable algebra by adding the evaporon Hilbert space or tensoring it with the boundary algebra. So I think that's the right setting to pose the question in, but it's just a technicality you have to do to be able to actually make this black hole evaporate. Otherwise, it'll just, all the energy will just remain that you put in. It's kind of a time reverse of the process of making the black hole. You're trying to suck out energy. So let's let the Hilbert space at the boundary, that's an algebra, not a Hilbert space, whoops. Okay, it's like the H associated with that algebra tensor evaporon. Okay, now we can finally ask the firewall question. So we're going to suck out this particle into the evaporon reservoir. It's running alongside here. And the same argument Don gave can be upgraded to be that the observables in this algebra evolve unitarily, or the algebra of that operators in that Hilbert space. So that means that this must be in a pure state taken together with the other boundary degrees of freedom, but it's entangled, but it came from a Hawking quantum entangled with its partner. And so how can it possibly be in a pure state? And to answer this, I think it's good to clarify the question by getting rid of the black hole, because you realize it's really not a black hole question. It's a puzzle that exists immediately from the time the first Hawking quantum comes out. And it's simply related to the fact that this is correlated, it's entangled with some other degree of freedom. It doesn't even have to be something inside the black hole. So let's modify it this way. We're going to send in two particles, but instead of colliding to form a black hole, they're going to just miss each other. They'll interact, but not form a black hole. And this one will make it out to the boundary there. And this one will get deflected and not reach the boundary until over there. Yes?
So how is this unitary? You're saying that what you're proposing that the particles that reach the boundary, they're absorbed into this evaporon mass or something like that.
Yeah.
But the reverse could also be happening, that particles from the evaporon bath should be able to leak into.
That's why we took the bath to be, took it to be a, it's like a non-compact dimension that the field lives in. So you generate this evaporon excitation, and it propagates away, and it never returns. So
it's
you have to.
It has infinite volume.
Yeah, it has infinite volume, and the initial state of it is the vacuum, and so nothing's coming in. It's just a device to be able to precisely talk about receiving information about these Hawking quanta at the boundary. Okay, so, but we create another situation where we have a puzzle here. The puzzle is just as great. We had some information at the boundary initially. We knew what we threw in. We threw in something there, the state of the boundary, well, let's say all observables at the boundary are evolving unitarily. And yet, the evaporon at the boundary, which responds to the arrival of this particle, seems to be entangled, like because this particle is entangled with that particle. Right? If two particles interact, or they might even, you know, annihilate and then recreate another pair of particles. So there's actually entanglement here, which doesn't show up at the boundary until much later. So we already seem to have a contradiction with Don's claim. How can it be that the boundary observables evolve unitarily up to here? Obviously, there's missing information. So if we can explain why this is not a contradiction, then we can explain why there's no firewall. Okay. Well, the only way out of this conclusion, logically, is if the information contained in this second particle, let's call it particle 2, has a representation at the boundary. Right? Because this is entangled with that, but this has got to be pure in the boundary. So there must be a representation of particle 2 in the boundary at this time. there must be a representative of 2 in the boundary at time of arrival of 1. But the boundary is just determined by the asymptotic values of the bulk fields. So it looks like we're saying that information has to be encoded in 2 places at the same time. Information in this particle 2 in the bulk, and also in something asymptotically at the boundary. So it's multiple encoding of the same information, redundant encoding. So this requires redundant encoding of information. Now, why would anybody think there might be redundant encoding of information? The answer is, it's covered up. The answer is the constraints. We're talking about some state. Let's say I'm speaking in the Heisenberg picture. The state should be annihilated by the constraint operators. In particular, for the time component, that's the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So the constraints imply redundant encoding. This comes from the constraints. Now, in what sense would it come from the constraints? Well, the 0, 0 component of Einstein's equation in the Newtonian limit is just Poisson's equation for the gravitational potential. So it tells you, if I have some matter distribution, what's the gravitational field everywhere, including its fall off at infinity? What's the total mass? Now, it seems like there's not that much information in that. And at the classical level, I think there isn't probably adequate information. But we're talking about the quantum version of the constraint. And I think the way you have to think about it is this. The vacuum of the quantum gravity theory is not empty space. It's quantum fluctuations of all the degrees of freedom in the theory. And that state has to be annihilated by the constraint operators. And the constraint operators are encoding the gravitational imprint of all forms of energy and momentum in the system. And there's a lot of ways that you can tickle a vacuum fluctuation to imprint some kind of information onto it. So this is my intuitive understanding of why it might be possible that the constraints could actually imply this multiple encoding. Yeah.
So now I'm going to bring back my particle with the charge that's not coupled to anything long lane, and have your quanta that came from the boundary not scatter from another quanta that came from the boundary, but scatter with that. And certainly the information.
That, wait, the second thing it scattered from was inside?
Just one photon comes from the boundary, one quantum comes from the boundary.
Yeah.
Scatters with the particle that started at time, in minus infinity inside the.
Right.
So I'm carrying a value of the charge, which is not measurable by any long wave.
Right.
But supposing that the details of the scattering do depend on the value of that charge.
Yeah. Well, then it's in the Hamiltonian depends on that value, and that imprints onto the constraints and onto the asymptotic Hamiltonian.
But the Hamiltonian doesn't contain any information about that. The Hamiltonian.
If it doesn't, then that charge won't affect the scattering.
The Hamiltonian, the boundary Hamiltonian does not know about that. The Hamiltonian constraint does know about that, I agree. But you see,
the boundary Hamiltonian is the whole Hamiltonian for things that commute with the constraints.
But you're relying on the constraint constraint on the elliptic equation of the constraint or its quantum generalization to get information from the bulk into the boundary?
I'm not saying again that all information, I don't have to be able to read out what particle was in the bulk and what charge it had. Only the way that charge affects the scattering of my particle that came from the boundary has to be readable. So it seems completely unavoidable. There, in other words, there's no further complication caused by your particle being in the bulk.
So the picture then is the constraints encode this information for both 2 and 1.
Yes.
Prior to 1 hitting. So does something different happen when 1 actually hits the boundary?
Well, there's certainly local dynamics, but I'm not sure what you mean by something different.
Well, you've got redundant information, but then the two things coalesce.
Oh, right. That's right. It could be that the redundancy coalesces. Look, since this is a pretty exotic idea, I cooked up a simple example to illustrate it, which actually is slightly more complicated than the last time I spoke here about it. It makes it a little bit richer and a little bit more impressive. Let me show you an example of a model system, a toy quantum gravity, where we have a symmetry, and therefore we have constraints, and we have observables that commute with the constraints, and we have a physical states that are annihilated by the constraints, and those states have multiple encoding in some way that seems very analogous to what I'm talking about here. Is there any board I have not written on? Good question. Wait a second. Have I already told you? No, I didn't tell you.
Okay.
That's going to come. Well, actually, I can just say that. What is that I don't understand about this? That doesn't have what I wanted to. Okay, let me actually answer that because I don't want you to lose. Before I say this. So remember, I went to the example of the scattering particles away from the black hole just to identify that we already have a puzzle there. If it's correct that the solution of that puzzle is that there's a representative of particle 2 in the boundary, then for the case of the black hole, I would also say there's a representative of A tilde, the partner of the Hawking quantum, in the boundary.
ADS boundary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And therefore, from the moment the first Hawking quantum emerged from the black hole, the first one, forget halfway through, it has to arrive at the boundary and be pulled out by the evaporon coupling. It has to already be in a pure state when taken together with all the other boundary observables. Because the boundary is evolving unitarily in a continuous way. It's not just that the final state is unitarily related to the initial one. But if there's a representative of the Hawking partner, A tilde, in the boundary, well, then everything's fine. When the first Hawking quantum arrives at the boundary, it is entangled with other boundary degrees of freedom, which together with which it forms a pure state. And there's no firewall problem because the Hilbert space structure that we assumed to get the problem was this. It was A tilde tensor A tensor E. And the strong subadditivity inequality on this entropy came from really assuming you have a Hilbert space made of three tensor factors. If the constraint has to act on this and project out some subspace, that projection can basically tie together different pieces of this tensor product in such a way that you can't derive that strong subadditivity inequality because you just don't have a tensor product. This is where the example I'm going to show you now is very helpful because it sounds abstract and mysterious, but it's actually not so mysterious. It's just that we're not used to it in this context.
Based on that, right? It's a very simple argument. You're just saying that there is one hypothesis in the firewall argument, which is just obviously wrong. The decomposition of the, that's a fact. So I think you're very shy about it. It could be saying two words. The totally best place being split into local pieces like that,
yeah,
it's obviously wrong because the constraint is a number of objects.
Yes.
And so, you know, so it just precludes any, you know, any, I think the burden of the proof is now on the people in the firewall camp showing that under other hypotheses,
I fully agree with you.
So it's so direct and simple that I don't know why you have to go through so much
confusion
to be so careful.
Yeah,
I
think it's interesting. It makes it even more compelling the fact that the same constraint which invalidates the firewall argument
makes
the unitarity valid in the first place.
So killing the firewall takes half a line, right? You could keep it in half a line with this argument. Then, I think, then you have an interesting discussion that this is related to unitarity, right? I think.
Let me get to this example because we're already over time and I don't want to try people's patience, but I'd hate for you to leave without seeing this simple example that's very memorable. So let's consider our world consists of four spin J systems. That's our theory. And our symmetry is going to be rotation invariance instead of diffeomorphisms. And our constraints that come from that will be that the generator of, so only Yeah, that the generator of rotations, the total angular momentum operator, annihilates the states. So they must be singlets. And observables, in my toy theory, will be things that are rotationally invariant. So they have to commute with the total angular momentum. And now let's consider an example of such a system, where I have these four spin J's. So we start with a kinematical Hilbert space, H-kin, that's J tensor, J tensor, J tensor, J. And the physical Hilbert space is the obtained by projecting out the singlet part of that. So we take the singlet projection on H kinematic is H physical. So what does that look like then? It means we're supposed to find the singlet states inside this tensor product. We can do that by grouping them any way we want, but let's take this pair and this pair. J tensor J is a sum of spins from 0 up to 2J. So this factor becomes 0 plus 1 plus 2 plus 2J, and the same thing for the second factor. And we're supposed to find the singlets here. And I can't get a singlet by multiplying, let's say, 1 by 0 or 1 by 2. The only singlet I can make with this is tensoring it with 1. And then I get a singlet, triplet, and a spin 2. So for every pair in the diagonal, I get a single singlet state. So it looks like I have exactly 2j plus 1 different singlet states in this Hilbert space. So what I get is equals the spin 0 singlet, the one I got from spin 1, and the one I got from spin 2, etc. And then the rest is non-singlets. Plus non-singlet. So the observables in this theory, we can write down a complete set of observables, let's say projection operators, that project onto these different singlets. And any observable could be written in terms of those projection operators. Now, how would I measure that? Well, look where it came from. If I just measure these two spins, I know which of the total angular momentum states I had. So therefore, I know which one of the singlets I have, just from measuring these two guys. Or I could have measured these two guys. And I would have known what their total spin was, but that would have also told me the same quantum information. So the same qubits are stored in completely different pieces of the system, that is, this pair of spins or this pair of spins, as a result of the fact that the physical Hilbert space is not a linear, a tensor product, but it's a subspace of a tensor product. And so just that's the point I wanted to make, that the logical structure of the quantum gravity constraint is the same. And therefore, there's no reason why it would be mysterious that there could be multiple encoding at the boundary and in the bulk of the same information. So let me, that's pretty much probably what I want to say. Yeah, since I've run over, I'm going to stop and not make some points about ADS-CFT and about the form that the multiple encoding takes. Maybe I'll say one thing about that because it's so interesting. So this is just conceptual. There must be some way that the partner is encoded in the boundary. What is that way? Well, let's consider the case where we have a lot of language and some insight about A infinity, namely ADS-CFT. Then what happens when you form a black hole in ADS-CFT by throwing stuff in from the boundary is you get a thermal state of either a subsystem or the whole boundary system. And then when a Hawking quantum is absorbed at the boundary, that's just like some little thermal fluctuation in some degree of freedom of the boundary field theory at a certain place. But if you form the black hole starting with the pure state, even though it looks thermal, it's actually a pure state with all kinds of complicated entanglement built into it. And in particular, that little fluctuation you just absorbed energy from is entangled with all of the other boundary degrees of freedom in this field theory. So the representative of the Hawking partner behind the horizon is the rest of the degrees of freedom in the boundary that are thermalized with this Hawking quantum. It's extremely complicated. That sounds wild, but that's sort of exactly the way it should be, because how did a partner get imprinted by the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in the boundary? It's just the slight effects that the fact that that Hawking pair was created had on the vacuum of all the degrees of freedom in the system that just shifted things in some incredibly impossible to measure way, but it did. And so, of course, we don't pick it up when we make normal measurements. So for practical purposes, we've lost the information, but in principle, it's there for that reason. So I should end there and just say, there's not much calculation here, but conceptually, I'm satisfied, actually, that this explains why, under those circumstances where I should believe in unitarity, or the sense in which I should believe in it, there's no reason to believe in a firewall. Yeah, I have to plead confusion. I'm not confident enough yet about it. I don't understand. Don's argument was considerably more subtle for the asymptotically flat case. We can talk about it. I guess in short, I would say yes. I think basically the same story holds on Scribe Plus. In other words, that I've not thought about at all.
So a question. So I totally agree with your argument. That is the fact that firewall argument should be really easy. But it's so easily said that, that somehow, you know, there's a question, why there's so many people still believing in the firewall argument and not just going back to the drawing board. So let me try to push a bit further forward the argument. I think, so I agree, this is what you're saying is right. Now, most people believe, or it seems that it's a misleading, most people would believe that, in fact, the Hilbert space will look like this local splitting. And the reason is that most of the analysis is done in a linearized regime, where in the linearized regime, you can split somehow the Coulombic mode from the spin to traceless mode. And in this regime, let's say you can throw out the Coulombic mode, not thinking about how it quantizes, and then only focus on the spin two modes. And then for that, if you look at just that, you know, Hamiltonian constraint in the linear regime, then in fact, you can still somehow solve the constraint and get input space that factorized by that. So I think there's something extra in your argument, which is that you have to invoke the non-linearity. Right? That is, otherwise,
yes.
That explains somehow, that explains why people spend so many years not just, you know, addressing that. So that is.
But the amount of non-linearity you have to invoke is very small.
No, I know. I totally agree. I'm just saying, I'm on your side, but I'm just saying, you know, it would be, that's, I think, because your argument is so obvious that, you know, you would say, okay, the first time you hear it, everybody should go back and just revisit that. But it, that's not what what's happening.
No.
So my
and Don is
my
has
understanding.
Pointed out one
yeah,
of
but
the
my understanding. Yeah, because Don also believed that. You know, but when I talk to him, he believes that because he's always using this linear argument. So I'm thinking.
But if you read his paper, he himself made the point. He first argued boundary unitarity on a perturbative basis. And he used exactly the argument you made, that even in the linearized case, if you go to nonlinear order just enough to encode the integral of the stress tensor of the gravitons in the boundary flux integral, that's all you have to do to get this conclusion.
But I guess that's maybe what's needed next, that is to show that even if you start from the basis for small perturbation, show this structure.
He did show it. It's in his paper.
Okay, then, okay. Well, but let's say that's the non-trivial.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's really due to the non-linearity, not only the constraints, but the non-linearity.
That's true.
That's what I wanted to emphasize. It's not enough to have just constraints, it's to have, you know.
Right. But it's a known thing in general relativity. If you just stick to linear, you sort of can't even get the orbits of planets. You know that funny argument, the stress tensor. If you just analyze the whole theory at linear order, then the conservation law for the stress tensor of a planet says that it goes on a geodesic of the background, and then you don't even get an orbit. So it's a. I mean, of course, we should include nonlinear effects if we're talking about gravity.
Let's also explain why it might be difficult to you know, detect, because it's really due to this back reaction via the Coulombic mode. And that's why it's hard, you know,
now, I must say, so what should one do next? I mean, I would love to understand better, if it's possible, about how this multiple encoding works. Mm-hmm. So can we look at the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and think about the structure of the vacuum and how the Wheeler-DeWitt equation operates on that and see somehow, make a connection between this picture of the entanglement with all the thermal partners in the boundary and the local terms in the Hamiltonian or Lagrangian that somehow gave rise to that through the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. That's not clear to me in any detail at all.
Yeah, it's a beautiful argument. I agree with Murat. It's impressively correct. But what do you think now about the reasons why you originally didn't believe in boundary unitarity? So, at least when we used to talk about it, you didn't believe it for the same reason I didn't believe it, because there's the possibility that the big universe being created and information going there. If I understand your argument correctly, nothing in this point of view precludes the possibility that the big universe is created. You would just have the multiple encoding.
Right. Although, yeah, I completely agree with that, except there is an independent argument against baby universes in ADS-CFT. Now, whether that applies in the asymptotically flat case, I have no idea. But I'm even surprised that there's an argument against it in ADS-CFT.
What's
the argument? The argument is that you can, using these evaporons, you can extract all the energy in the bulk spacetime and take the system back down to the ground state in the boundary. And then by invoking the non-degeneracy of the ground state of the CFT, there can't be baby universe degeneracies in that state. Now wait, does that really imply though? Actually, I don't think, I have to think about it, but I don't think that even argues that there can't be baby universes. I think it may just be a different, it's just unobservable from the boundary.
Right, but you're very happy with the idea that there are 12 observables that are not present on the boundary.
Absolutely. In fact, if there weren't, what would we do in quantum cosmology when there's no boundary? The theory would have to be completely meaningless, but I don't believe it is meaningless. In fact, Don made a suggestion in his paper also about what to do in that case, which was kind of intriguing. And it's sort of just the old idea of using internal clocks. So he just said, you know, if you have a clock in your system, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation will tie the Hamiltonian for the clock to the rest of the system. And so you might be able to think of that as sort of surrounding your clock by an inner boundary and then evolving observables on this sort of clock boundary in a meaningful way in this theory.
Except when people try to do that in models, you lose the unitarity. You get decoherence on the clock boundary.
Right. Or you get...
It's not necessarily bad, it's just bad.
Right. Well, actually, I think losing unitarity in quantum cosmology is a good thing, is my latest view. Because I don't understand probability in quantum mechanics anyway. But that's another discussion. You haven't said anything.
Yes. How can I be sure that this data encoding is just a different thing for quantum zeros?
Quantum Xeroxing?
Yeah, which is forbidden.
Yeah, so this is something Don mentioned explicitly in his paper, but it's not Xeroxing, because Xeroxing is when you're copying onto another tensor factor. But the whole point is this isn't another tensor factor. It's just multiply encoded the same qubit. So it's not Xeroxing.
Okay, I think we should maybe close the general discussion, and everyone who wants to continue the discussion is of course welcome to stay, but first let's thank Ted again.